This is a podcast from the South China Morning Post.
Hello and welcome to the US-China Trade War Podcast. I'm Finbar Birmingham on the political economy desk here at the South China Morning Post. Across Hong Kong, our staff are working in various degrees of isolation and quarantine as we continue to practice the sort of social distancing that we hope will see us out the other side of the coronavirus outbreak safe and sound. And that means that once again, we are recording remotely. But I've got a new mic, which is stacked precariously on a pile of books, so everything is fine. This week, I'll be talking with John Carter and Joe Shin, the political economy editors here at the SCMP, to discuss new numbers on China's slowly recovering economy, but the big hit that's coming ahead. We will be discussing the politics and economics of mask exports, which, mark my words, will be the title of more than one postgraduate thesis in the years to come. I'm also delighted to be joined by Frank Lavin. Frank was the political director for President Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. He was at one time the US ambassador for Singapore. He was the Undersecretary for Commerce for International Trade under George W. Bush, and he was the head of the International Trade Commission in the 2000s. You might say he knows a thing or two about trade and diplomacy. Frank discusses the political tensions between the US and China as this virus rages. This is an interview that we're really excited about. Hope you enjoy. See you on the other side. Delighted to be joined by political economy editors John Carter and Joe Shin from our respective locations dotted around Hong Kong. Guys, it's been another big week for the Chinese economy. We had the Purchasing Managers Index this week. This shows confidence of sentiment and of business conditions in the world's second largest economy. John, the numbers were better than they had been before, with the caveat that things are far from normal. Tell us about this week's PMI.
Okay, this is the PMI for March for both the manufacturing and the services sector. And after hitting historic lows in February for both indexes, they rebounded back in positive territory, suggesting that both sectors are expanding again. These numbers have to be taken with a grain of salt. It's a sentiment index, and so people are basically saying things are better than they were last month. But that's not the same thing as saying things are good. They're still struggling to get production back online. They're still trying, especially small businesses, are still having trouble getting customers in because people are staying home because of fear of the virus. So you can't say that the Chinese economy is back to normal. All you can say is that it is better than it was in February, which means the trough, at least for now, was in February and things are starting to improve slowly.
So, Joe Shin, this shows that China is recovering slowly. There are other signs that the economy is not going so well. Some of our reporters have been doing very interesting stories about bankruptcies in China, about consumer confidence in China. Is there genuine concern, Joe Shin, from within the country that this second wave of coronavirus impact is going to be very strong on the economy?
Oh, yes, there are growing worries that Chinese economy will be in a worse shape than previously expected, mainly because the global economy is slowing down as coronavirus become a global issue. And at least, Chinese exporters are complaining the sudden vanish. Suddenly, all the orders have been vanished, so their production cannot be continued. And we have a reporter on the ground in Dongguan, one of the heartland of manufacturing. And, there's so many companies, just only a few weeks ago, they're trying desperately to restart production, now are laying off workers, freezing new recruitment. And, this has been a situation that I haven't been seeing in the last decade, which means the labor salary was actually dropping in Dongguan. Because even though the new job seekers, the size of job seekers on the ground are much smaller than normal years, the demand for labor is even smaller. So this is quite worrying. And also for consumption, it's very difficult to get everything back to normal. As we can see in the past week, Shanghai has reclosed some tourist attractions, and all the cinemas in China, which has been open, which had been opened for a couple of days, and now they are facing a nationwide ban to close down again. And in Sichuan, these karaoke lounges, exactly like Hong Kong, you know, time is not ripe yet. So these kind of service venues has to be closed down. And even restaurants, there are new rules, like no more than, you know, three people can sit on the same table. So it's still quite a bleak picture. And this has a very negative impact on people's sentiment and also on their expectations of future incomes. Remember, you know, China has over 60%, nearly 60% of economy made of services. And there are really not many good news from this services sector.
Well, one sector which has been booming has been the medical equipment sector. Masks, testing kits, ventilators, they've been shipping these all over the world. We've seen various reactions to this. In some quarters, people are seeing it as a soft power move, but I think a lot of people have accepted the reality that the rest of the world needs these products and China can provide them. John Carter, from your perspective, do you see this as almost like a soft power move, or do you see it as an economic reality?
Well, it's both. I think that it's, you know, China is taking advantage of the situation as anyone would. And it's good for their image as long as they do it well. And there's been some question about the quality of some of the exports from China, which the Chinese government moved quickly to repair. But it is an economic reality given their ability to turn on a dime and start producing more medical equipment with their manufacturing base, which is already one of the biggest in the world. They're able to provide the world with the things that they need that the rest of the world doesn't have at the moment. So it's both. It's both diplomacy and it's economic reality.
And the item that you touched on, John, there about China trying to control the quality here, yesterday, Wednesday, the Chinese government changed the customs rules, which means that a product can only be sold, a medical product can only be sold overseas if it's approved for sale domestically. And we found out in our reporting that there were testing kits being sold across the European Union, which had not been approved for sale in China. And that was partially because China didn't need them. You know, China doesn't need all these testing kits anymore. And therefore, these companies didn't want to go through the process of getting the approval. I think just the very fact that stuff's been sold from China without approval for sale in China, very important equipment, resonated with a lot of people. Joe Shin, how did you read the Chinese government's intervention yesterday? Did you see that this was almost like a damage limitation thing? They don't want to be perceived as selling dodgy medical equipment to the rest of the world at a time of serious pandemic?
Oh, yes. I think, yeah, the Chinese government is trying to do some damage controls because, you know, in China, the mask production is kind of very imbalanced. You know, not only state-owned enterprises are producing it, but everyone, basically, the whole country is jump onto this wagon of producing masks. And if you look at even in domestic news, you know, every week the Chinese Supreme Court released a number of typical cases, illegal cases, and it's almost all about masks. You know, people are making lower quality masks. People are trying to, you know, faking famous brand masks. So when this problem spread to other countries through exports, you know, it's a tarnish for China's reputation. So apparently the Chinese government is trying to control the situation a little bit and not allowing everyone, you know, these kind of workshops that do not have even enough hygiene licenses to producing masks in a very quick fashion and then export it to other countries.
Yeah, and Joe Shin, I'm going to stick with you to talk politics for a moment. Chinese President Xi Jinping made a trip to Zhejiang province this week. Tell us a bit about the significance of that. First of all, Joe Shin, tell the listeners, why is Zhejiang province so important? Why did Xi Jinping choose it as the location of his trip? And what's the wider significance of this?
Yes, indeed. This is the first trip for Xi after his visit to Wuhan in middle March. In middle March, you know, Xi was in Wuhan to send the message that the Western time of China's coronavirus outbreak is over. And so his visit to Zhejiang, which is a very important export and manufacturing base in China, which is also happened to be the power base for President Xi, so has lots of significance. Number one is Xi is trying to, you know, the first stop for Xi's trip is the Ningbo port, which is number three world's largest container port. So apparently she's trying to say that, you know, now the domestic outbreak is over, we have to worry about the value chains. China has to keep its relevance in the global economy. And for ports like Ningbo, which is an important connecting dots between China and the rest of the world. So he also visited manufacturers attached to the port area. And he said he hopes them can resume production as quickly as possible, because this is not only good for themselves, for the workers, but also for the companies, for their employees, and for the country as a whole. And also for Zhejiang, it's not only a normal province, because many of Zhejiang's achievements has Xi's personal involvement a decade ago when he was party secretary in the province from 2002 to 2007. So after Ningbo, he visited the village. He visited exactly in 2005, and where he raised his famous philosophy of green development, which in the official language is like green hills are also equals to hills of mountains and silver. And in there, he was trying to stress the importance that despite the coronavirus, we still have to stick to this sustainable development idea and the green development. And also, he was quite pleased or quite proud to exemplify Hangzhou, the capital city of Zhejiang, as an example of social management. You know, in the outside world, there are lots of criticism and some negative comments about China's social control. You know, the Communist Party has a rigid grip of the whole society. But for Xi, it is something to be proud of. He said it's actually a capability, a governance ability of, you know, can keeping people when you want it, you can people at their homes. And when it's okay, you can allow millions of or tens of millions of people, you know, gradually return to works. And is this all made possible by the modern technologies in Hangzhou? So it is quite interesting for his trip to deliver these kind of policy messages.
There's always something to read between the lines with these trips. Before we go, what's the main highlights coming up over the next week, John, in the economic calendar?
In about 2 weeks, we will get the GDP report for the first quarter. Of course, this is the report everyone expects to be very negative, showing the first contraction in the Chinese economy since 1976. But we will also get March data for things like industrial production, retail sales, and investment. They were extremely weak in February, in line with the sentiment indicators. So we'll be able to see at that point whether the real economic data, these retail sales, production, and investment, will rebound like sentiment did. My suspicion is they will rebound, but not quite as well as sentiment did. So we'll see. But this will be our first report showing what the economy has done since the trough in February.
Good stuff. We look forward to seeing that. John, Zhou-Xin, thanks so much. Delighted to be joined by Frank Lavin. Frank is the CEO of Export Now, and he is a longtime US government official, having served in all sorts of roles across the decades. Frank, would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I started in the Reagan White House, which certainly dates me a bit. I was just a pup, I guess, and spent about half of my career in government, about half my career in business, including a big part of the career in Hong Kong, doing a lot of China facing activities in private equity with Citibank, with Edelman Public Affairs, a lot of China projects and tasks, and I'm all China facing now.
And I guess even in your two separate strands of your career, from government to commerce, you would never have seen anything like this. What we've seen over the past couple of months, everybody keeps telling me is unprecedented. But think back to your days in government and your days as a diplomat and as a presidential advisor. At this moment in time, we've got a pandemic raging, but the two global superpowers are at each other's throats, the US and China, taking pot shots. The blame game is going on and doesn't seem to be stopping. As a diplomat, put your diplomatic hat on, what sort of tools are you reaching for at this point to try and calm that down a bit? And also, as somebody who is a student of history, I know well, which examples from history are you looking to maybe see what lessons can be learned for this current situation?
Well, by the way, I certainly think your premise is spot on, that this is, I think, the most severe economic shock to the international system in decades, if not longer. And I think previous shocks have been localized, like the collapse of the tech sector, the U.S. stock exchange, or the EMU bond crisis and the Greek economic crisis. So there have been other shocks, but they tend to be localized, national level, sector specific shocks. This is going to be more global and more profound. It's the broad economy in each one of these countries that are affected, all of Europe, North America, China, are really going to be battered by this, and it's going to go on. I mean, the economic impact will go on for several quarters, so no doubt. And on top of that, you're right, there's this geopolitical competition or ongoing sort of low-level friction between the U.S. and China. And look, I'm never surprised when a country core message is that our problems stem from somebody else's mistakes. I'm not surprised that countries, I would say most countries, many countries, have that as a core line of their communications domestically. I think, though, I would advise anybody to be careful with that, because you don't want to get in sort of an arms race of ill will. You don't want to get in an open competition of insults and just encourage the other party to add fire to that bad karma going on. So, and I think, unfortunately, that's what we're drifting to. I would tell both Beijing and Washington, be careful about allowing the relationship to be defined entirely by negative messaging, and look for some ways to inject some kind of positive rhythm into this communication pattern, or at least dial down the negative so you can get back to some kind of equilibrium in the relationship.
Would there be anything in particular, like a practical measure that could be taken? I mean, we're all hoping that the pair of them will collaborate maybe on a vaccine or something like that. Is it as simple as a medical collaboration, or what would you recommend?
Well, the specific steps, I would say that the president of the United States would probably be better suited not to label coronavirus the China virus, the Wuhan virus. I would just make that suggestion to Washington. And to China, I would say, look, it is not in China's interest for a foreign ministry spokesman to be intimating that the United States willfully or purposefully caused this and contaminate China. That's enormously harmful to China, because it is going to be viewed as such bad faith action and cause ill will. So they shouldn't be doing that. But I'd say there's some other interesting steps China could take if they wanted to show a little leadership. I mean, it's striking to me that Taiwan is a productive member of the WTO and other international bodies, clearly on a non-sovereign basis. Why can't it be a member of the WHO? And could China help shepherd some kind of arrangement that would allow Taiwan to participate, not to enjoy sovereign status, but to contribute and to share in the benefits of membership? And it strikes me, if some step like that would be a strong signal to the international community that China wants to play a constructive leadership role and is not interested in bullying or shoving people around.
Yeah, these things, maybe it's a sign of how far things have fallen. The Taiwan situation in particular, that seems quite almost far-fetched, you know, the depth of feeling about China, Taiwan, WHO, all that stuff.
Yeah, I'm not an expert on the WHO, but I did work on the WTO role and the APEC role. And these are both international bodies that have formal decision-making capabilities, and Taiwan participates in both. But all parties state that Taiwan's participation is not a statement of sovereign rights. It's a little bit like Taiwan's participation in the Olympics. So the point is, there are mechanisms that will allow non-sovereign polities to participate, and I think it's viewed as beneficial if they do that. So it's just one idea that China could play a constructive role in that regard.
Sure. And moving on to another topic which has been in the news a lot this week, mask diplomacy, of diplomacy maybe you didn't have firsthand experience of yourself, Frank, but something which has really captured the imagination. We saw today Taiwan shipping 5.something million masks to the European Union. But China's really been behind a lot of this, sending PPE. And I think a point that's important to make is that it's not often gifted. This is often stuff that people have to pay for. But they're sending millions and millions of masks and ventilators and respiratory equipment and testing kits to the Europe, now to the US, I saw, to parts of Africa, the Middle East, around Asia. How does this look from a US government perspective? I mean, the US is obviously at a time of high crisis. China has come out the other side of it. But do you recall a time in your career or in history where the US has sort of been caught on the back foot in that way, and another power has stepped in to fill the vacuum?
Well, I would say this, Finbar, for under the Trump administration, and I would say to some extent under the Obama administration, the US has really stepped back from a global leadership role. Both presidents I think were somewhat similar in saying the historic role that emerged after World War II, the Cold War, that historic role was just too expensive. U.S. could get it wrong, could get involved in wars overseas, or else Trump's view was not necessarily maybe that so much, but that the nominal friendship of others is really uneven or unfair, and other countries put a burden on the United States. The United States isn't fairly sharing burden with others. So both presidents, I think, saw a little bit of a step back from U.S. international leadership over the past decade or so. And as a result, we are where we are today, that the United States, I think, has got an underfunded aid program, an underfunded international posture. And I think China's playing to its strength. It has considerable manufacturing capability, and it's stepping up. I'm not sure to what extent it is donating, to what extent it is selling. But in any event, it is China. This is the most comfortable China is in playing an international role that I've seen in my lifetime. So it's sending a very strong signal to the international community.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of people calling now for the U.S., as we've seen over the last few years, Frank, with the trade war and so on, for the U.S. to bring some of its manufacturing back home, reorganize the supply chain. Obviously, we know the cost factors. We know that it's not easy to bring manufacturing back to the U.S., but with your businessman's hat on at the moment, do you actually see that's been a feasible prospect where post-coronavirus, the U.S. does try and repatriate its medical supply chain and companies go along with that?
Well, I have to tell you, I have to make a confession that I'm an economic rationalist, which is to say, I think that markets should determine where economic activity takes place. So if you do think it's important that the United States enhance its manufacturing sector, you have to put a policy framework in place that makes that as inviting as possible, meaning the investment will go where market factors determine it should go. So the United States should look at its tax rate and its labor policy and other elements. I can tell you this, not one businessman in the U.S. woke up this morning saying, how can I move manufacturing offshore? How can I close down the U.S.? Nobody begins their day thinking of that. But sometimes they're pushed to think that way because the United States can be inhospitable. So if you are serious about U.S. manufacturing capabilities, I would start the conversation by saying, what can the U.S. do better to make the U.S. as attractive as possible? By the way, the U.S. has done that, I think, extremely well with automobile manufacturing, where all of the global majors from Japan, Korea, Germany, all of the global majors have located manufacturing facilities in the U.S. because it is a good platform for where to put a big part of your global supply chain, your global manufacturing capabilities. Can we do that again with pharmaceuticals or equipment in medicals? I think we certainly can, but it's going to be based on a policy framework.
Yeah, whether it's economically viable. And just to finish off, Frank, what do you see as the obvious legacies of this? And I know that we're in the middle of it, and sometimes it's hard to step out of the weeds and see the big picture. But when you look at the politics of this domestically in the United States, do you think this will cost Trump an election later in the year? Do you think that this will permanently damage U.S.-China relations? What do you think are the main vulnerabilities here?
Those are two essay questions. Let's try.
You've got 2 minutes.
exactly. Let's take them sequentially. Look, enormous discussion about Trump's adeptness or ineptness in handling this and what it means and what's going to happen. I take a different analytical framework. I would say if you and I are sitting down in November and saying, did this help or hurt him politically and to what extent, I would say 90% of the answer to that question is going to be U.S. Q3 economic performance. In other words, we know Q2 will be a contraction. We anticipate Q3 as a snapback. Tell me what the numbers are in Q3, and I'll tell you if Trump is going to get a pass or not. And I saw this when I was in the White House. We looked at a lot of polling data, and it was striking to me how people's approval, disapproval of any presidential policy, agriculture policy, transportation policy, foreign policy, depended on the economy. So if the economy is performing, presidents tend to get a pass. Right. And if they're not performing, they tend to get a fail. So the answer is look at those Q3 numbers, GDP and the net unemployment numbers and the growth rate and so forth. Look at all of that. And I'll tell you how this affects Trump. And don't focus on, well, yesterday at a press conference, he said something and it turned out to be exaggerated that will wash out. That will wash out to sea 6 months from now. That won't be what drives voter behavior.
But Frank, one thing that may interrupt that is the body count from this.
Sure.
You know, that's an unknowable, of course, at the moment. But is that one thing that may just?
It may, but it was striking to me. Yeah. Speaking of going from inept to, I think, astute, that Trump changed the goalpost. That he had a policy struck me as very odd a month ago of minimizing this, and now he seems to be overstating it. So a month ago we were saying, well, maybe 15 people have this. And now as people are saying, well, 100,000 to 200,000 deaths. So, I mean, I don't know how adeptly he's done this, but he shifted the goalpost rather dramatically to say, experts are looking at 1 to 200,000 deaths in the U.S. So if I come in less than that, I've done a great job. So I think he's already sort of sensing what you're suggesting, that mm-hmm. it's going to get a lot worse than it is today. It's not going to come anywhere near 100,000. And I can tell you something. At the Republican convention or the formal campaign kickoff in September, Trump will be surrounded by medical professionals in white lab jackets, and he will say, these are the heroes. This is the group that brought America back from the brink and turned it around. And ladies and gentlemen, may I ask for a round of applause for our healthcare professionals that dedicated themselves to making us safe. And he is going to own that issue or try to own it. By the way, the Democrats will try to do the same thing, but Trump seems more astute at sort of stage management, and he has the enormous advantage of being the incumbent, having that bully pulpit of the presidency. So, but the Democrats will see the same thing, that they'll want to salute the healthcare workers. they'll ask for a moment of silence to mourn the dead as well.
So, and just on the final question, Frank, the second essay question, is this going to upend permanently U.S.-China relations?
I don't think it upends is the good news, but I'll tell you, we're in a long-term period, I think, of secular deterioration. So that's the bad news. So I don't think this changes that, and I don't think it necessarily accelerates it, but what you have are an ascendant power in China and an establishment incumbent leadership power in the United States, and I think there might be a lack of statecraft on both sides about how can this new power define its role in the world that doesn't supplant or directly challenge the incumbent power. And that story is still being written, but I've not been impressed with the tactical capabilities in either Beijing or Washington to date. So I see more deterioration in the bilateral relationship, unfortunately.
Absolutely. Frank, that has been absolutely superb. And as always, great to talk to you, and we hopefully catch up with you soon.
Finbar, thanks for having me on. It's fun. Enjoyed the chat. I hope to see you. Hope they'll let me travel to Hong Kong again. I come back and see you. Thanks, Finbar.
Thanks for listening to the US-China Trade War Podcast with me, Finbar Birmingham. Please take a moment to like, share, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you happen to be listening. You can follow us on Twitter at SEMP Economy. I'm at F Birmingham. That's Birmingham with a B-E-R, not like the city. And follow updates on the SEMP.com website for 24-hour coverage of how this virus is unfolding and how it's affecting the Chinese and the global economy. Wash your hands, keep your distance, and we will see you next week.
For more podcasts from the South China Morning Post, head to SEMP.com, where you can hear more about technology, trade, culture, and society.